You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the latest United Nations report on biodiversity paints a grim picture for the health of more than 1 million species on the planet, and it says we humans could end up paying a big price. First, when people go to prison, in most states, they lose their right to vote, and many felons never get it back. The issue has come up in the Democratic presidential primary campaign. Several candidates have weighed in on the issue lately. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders was asked about it at a recent CNN town hall. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
So I believe that people who commit crimes, they pay the price. When they got out of jail, I believe they certainly should have the right to vote. But I do believe that even if they are in jail, they're paying their price to society, but that should not take away their inherent American right to participate in our democracy.
Some Democratic candidates have stopped short of agreeing with Sanders and turned to other criminal justice reforms. Here's New Jersey Senator Cory Booker.
I just think that that is a frustrating debate that we seem to now be having. As a guy who lives in an inner city black community and knows that there are millions of Americans that are being arrested and convicted and should never be there in the first, and not only lose their right to vote, but they lose their liberty. Let's get this conversation back to where it is right now.
States have tackled voting rights for current and former inmates in a lot of different ways, from maintaining voting rights in all cases to taking them away even after a sentence is served. Sheila Betty is a clinical professor of law at Northwestern University. She's also an attorney with the Roderick and Solange MacArthur Justice Center. Sheila, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, as I touched on there briefly, Sheila, there's a wide variety of approaches from state to state when it comes to current and former prison inmates and whether they can vote. Can you give us a sense of the range of practices we see around the country?
Sure, absolutely. So there are some states that prohibit people from voting after they have served their sentence, after they have been released from prison, if they are convicted of certain crimes. They are then not allowed to engage or to vote at all. There are other states, there's two states where there are no restrictions. And then there are some states that impose restrictions on voting for people who are in prison, who are on parole, or who are on probation. So these are folks who have committed crimes that don't necessarily result in incarceration. So there's no national practice when it comes to felon disenfranchisement.
Now, we heard Senator Cory Booker there, presidential candidate, saying he'd like to see us focus on more fundamental issues of who's incarcerated. That said, is it worth focusing in particular, even if we do talk about those other issues, focusing in particular on the voting rights or disenfranchisement of current and former felons?
Sure. I mean, rolling back mass imprisonment should be a fundamental issue in this election, and I think we've seen signs that it will be. But the issue, the fact that there is a debate about whether people in this country who are otherwise eligible to vote, I think that that's an incredibly important issue. And in many reasons, it's because of the origins of this practice. This is a practice that went back to England, and the idea that when you commit an offense, you are subject to some sort of civil death, that you then don't participate in society in the same way. But in this country, in many ways, because of the ways in which the criminal justice system is so intertangled with our legacy of white supremacy, those laws have been used in ways that are incredibly racially targeted. And the numbers really bear this out when you look at the ways in which these laws have disproportionately affected black and brown communities, particularly black communities, where one out of every 13 black people have lost their rights to vote because of felony disenfranchisement.
Yeah, can you talk a little more about the origins of these kind of laws, the removal of the right to vote from people who are convicted? Where does that come from in the United States?
So in the United States, you can really trace the origin of many of these laws from the Deep South and from laws that were put into place during Reconstruction. So at the end of slavery, when people who were previously slaved were then freed, there was a real move in the state capitals across the Deep South to enact laws that would, number one, give the criminal justice system a lot of heft, expand the reach of the justice system so that it was really functioning as a tool of social control, and then ensuring that people who were caught up in the system would not then be able to participate in civil life. And in many ways, those laws have expanded in their reach and have done exactly what the white supremacists who are running the state capitals and post-Reconstruction hoped they would do, which is sort of create a second tier of citizenship.
Talking to Sheila Betty, clinical professor of law at Northwestern University, about current and former prison inmates and what their voting rights are. It varies around the country. Here in Wisconsin, people in prison, on parole, and probation can't vote. Those with felony convictions can vote upon completion of their sentence. So going back again to that post-Reconstruction era, Sheila, did this happen, this removal of the right to vote, in great enough numbers to sway outcomes of elections?
Well, I mean, you know, the historical context is very difficult because there were so many restrictions on people's rights to vote if you were not a white man, right? But, I mean, period. Almost nobody had the right to vote. There was a short time period where that wasn't exactly true, but overall, the people who were voting during that time period were white landowning men. I think what we do know at this point is, given the reach of this practice, given the breadth of this practice, that it certainly would sway electoral outcomes now, and in part because it's just been so expansive.
I want to look at Florida for a moment, because we recently had this change where former felons would get the right to vote, and now we see the legislature passing a law that would require people to pay certain legal fees or not get that right to vote. What are you looking at in this story as it moves on in Florida?
You know, in some ways, it's a common backlash, right? There was a sort of forward progressive moving gain, where people who were disenfranchised were going to have the opportunity to get their rights back, and then you have lawmakers saying, "Wait, hold up a second, let's make this even more difficult." And really, when you think about the importance of democracy, when you think about sort of what it means to be able to participate in civil society, the idea that people are prioritizing putting effort and political clout into keeping people from voting should trouble everyone, no matter where you land on the political spectrum, because there's no real justification for denying people the right to vote that's grounded in things like public safety, creating vibrant communities. There's no rationalization for this practice that can really be legitimized other than as a tool of white supremacy.
Since Senator Sanders had talked about this, the idea of people in prison being able to vote, people have brought up an extreme case pointing to, say, the Boston Marathon bomber, saying, would you really want him to have the right to vote? What do you think of that question coming up and the responses you've seen to it?
I mean, frankly, it's a ridiculous question, because when you look at the vast majority of people who have been disenfranchised, they have not committed such heinous crimes. But also, I have no problem saying absolutely yes, that people who commit very serious crimes should have the right to vote. I don't believe that there is any sort of line drawing that needs to happen. This is a fundamental right that is required in order to make our democracy work.
The idea, I guess, is that, okay, if you have been convicted of a crime, you can be forced to relinquish some rights, various rights to liberty, you're incarcerated. This would be another way to do that, another example of a right that you can lose if you cross a certain line. Is there an argument to be made there?
I don't think it can be a valid argument. You're correct that if you are convicted of a crime and sent to prison, you then do lose some important fundamental rights. The justification for the deprivation of those rights is related to the idea of containment, of keeping you in one place so that you can no longer hurt somebody else, and to some extent rehabilitation, so that you can get access to services that can help you make good life decisions further down the road. So you can see why in some circumstances, given those justifications, there is a relinquishment of some rights. The imposition on the right to vote can't be tailored to either one of those legitimate means. There's just nothing that can justify it from a public safety perspective. And it's important to know that even though people do give up some of their rights when they go to prison, very important rights remain. The right to, for example, file lawsuits, the right to some forms of First Amendment expression, the right to maintain some connections with people in the outside world under some circumstances. So there are rights that do remain for people who are imprisoned, and there's no real rational justification for depriving people of the right to vote.
We're talking to Sheila Betty, clinical professor of law at Northwestern University, looking at the issue of voting rights for people in prison and those who have served their sentences. Laws vary from state to state. Sheila, before we go to our callers, do you see nationwide trends where states are getting more or less restrictive on voting rights for people in prison or who have been in prison?
It does seem like there is a trend, and in many ways, Florida has been at the forefront of this, of rolling back these restrictions. And in part, many of the arguments for rolling back the restrictions have been grounded in the reality of the arguments that were made to disenfranchise people in the first place. And those arguments all sounded in white supremacy and really sort of highlighted the ways in which the entire justice system has been used as a tool of social control to try to institutionalize a racial hierarchy.
Is there something to be said for, as we mentioned, some people made the argument that allowing someone in prison to vote is a way for them to connect to civil society? It might be part of the rehabilitation process.
Absolutely. There's really powerful research that talks about both recidivism rates and the ways in which recidivism rates drop significantly based on people who have strong connections to the outside world, people who are able to engage in life outside of prison. And in this country, being able to engage in electoral politics, being able to vote, being able to inform yourself about the issues and know that your vote is going to matter, it's one of the most basic ways in which we do that. It gives people skin in the game. And that's an incredibly important thing when we're thinking long term, when we're realizing that mass imprisonment has exploded the numbers of people who live behind bars right now. Most of those people are coming home. So as we begin to think about how we want to treat people who are returning to our communities, ensuring that they're engaged while they're away is an incredibly important strategy to ensure that we've got safe streets.
Let's bring on a caller now. David is with us in Prairie Farm. David, hi.
Hi.
What do you think, David?
This is David.
Yeah, what do you think?
Can you hear me?
Yep, go for it.
I don't believe that they should have the right to vote. I mean, in our society nowadays, we're not holding people accountable. If they are going to commit a felony, you have to realize you're going to lose some rights as a citizen of the United States. I mean, if we just keep doing this, let's just let them have guns. Okay, we've got somebody who went to prison for committing murder, and he did it with an automatic rifle. But that's okay. You can vote. And, well, you know what? Let's let you have some guns, too.
David, thanks for the call. David, seeing a slippery slope when it comes to accountability for people who have committed crimes, it sounds like.
Right. Well, and I mean, David brings up a topic perhaps for another show about the lax restrictions on selling guns. But I think the real focus is that the point of imprisonment is the containment. That is the punishment. The other kinds of punishments that we have added on as a society, like the ways in which people are disenfranchised, like the ways in which records follow people around like a scarlet letter, that is all about creating a sort of social death for people. That is all about institutionalizing the racial hierarchy I spoke about earlier.
Thanks for the call, David. We'll go now to Lydia in Duluth, Minnesota. Lydia, hi.
Hi.
What do you think, Lydia?
I think that when people are committed a crime and they're taken away their right to vote, but we expect them to live within the rules of the society, but then we're not giving them a part of creating the rules of that society in which they're bound by the laws. I just think that kind of we expect you to be a citizen, but you don't get to be a citizen.
Lydia, thanks for the call. So Lydia sees a contradiction there. Obey the rules, but you don't get to participate in them. What do you think, Sheila?
Well, Lydia has brought up a really important point that a lot of scholars have studied, and it's a theory that's called procedural justice, which is that if you have a process that is fair, if you have a process that recognizes the fundamental humanity of the people who are involved, and it makes sense, and that people have a role and a voice and an ability to sort of shape both the rules that are going to control them and also the outcome of those rules, that often both public safety outcomes and things like recidivism, public safety outcomes increase and recidivism is reduced significantly. So I think she hits on a really powerful point that has played out in a lot of the studies of this area over the years.
Lydia, thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Sheila Betty, clinical professor of law at Northwestern University and an attorney with the Roderick and Solange MacArthur Justice Center, looking at the issue of voting rights for current prison inmates and felons who have completed their sentence. A lot of different rules around the country when it comes to whether and when they can vote. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. John is with us in Westport and Florida. John, hi. Are you there, John?
Oh, yes, I am.
Yep, go ahead, John.
I just wanted to comment on the ballot initiative that was passed in Florida. I wanted to make sure that everybody understood that this was a ballot initiative that was approved by at least 60% of the people that voted for that initiative. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it was also a constitutional amendment. And I just think it's so outrageous that the legislature is attempting to override that and take away the decision of the people in this case.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Sheila, we talked a little bit about Florida earlier. What do you think of what John has to say?
Well, I think it's such a typical backlash that we see whenever there are real civil rights gains for people of color, and then you've got an establishment that's trying to undo those gains. I think that the success of that ballot initiative was really unparalleled, and I think that again, the measure that was passed by the Florida legislature again is not grounded in anything, and I'm hopeful that there could be court challenges to the ways in which they've tried to roll that back.
Let's bring on another caller. Thanks for calling in. Leonard is with us in Big Falls. Leonard, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Leonard?
Well, I spent 3 years in prison, and I never committed a crime with a gun or anything, and I feel that people should be able to hunt, you know, if they never committed a crime with a gun. And I think Wisconsin is, my parole officer told me years ago when I got out that I could vote after I finished my parole. And it's been since 2009 since I've been out, and I bought a house. I was broke when I got out and only had the shirt on my back. And since then, I've gotten my own place out in the country, and I've been doing real good. I do vote. I've checked into it online, and it says I could, but
yep.
I'm not real sure on the law there. But
and Leonard, let me just ask you real quick, what does that vote mean to you?
It means a lot. You know, it makes me feel like I'm part of the community.
Leonard, thanks a lot for calling in. So there's what you were talking about a little bit earlier, Sheila, that idea of somebody coming out of prison, voting is part of what that connection to the community, as Leonard just said.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And having that kind of connection and having a sense that you have that you will have a voice, and that just because you have a past of imprisonment, it doesn't mean that you can't do what Leonard has done and come out and contribute to your community. That's exactly, you know, one of the things that's really anchored the debate around rolling back these restrictions.
Thanks for that call, Leonard. And Sheila, in our last minute or so, this issue, as we said at the outset, is coming up on the presidential campaign trail. From what you've seen, is this a productive discussion that's coming out of the Democratic candidates when it comes to voting rights for current and former inmates?
It's an important conversation, and it's a conversation that would be very difficult to imagine happening, you know, 8 years ago. I do think that the more fundamental conversation needs to be, why are we locking so many people up? The more fundamental conversation needs to be about what are these candidates going to do to roll back mass imprisonment to the extent they've got the ability to do it at the federal level. I think that the idea that we have not yet seen Democratic candidates run on a campaign that has been targeted at fear and targeted at putting more power into the criminal justice system is a good thing. But I do think that we want to see some more targeted analysis from the candidates.
We'll leave it there for now. Sheila, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Sheila Betty, clinical professor of law at Northwestern University and an attorney with the Roderick and Solange MacArthur Justice Center. She's with us to talk about the practice of disenfranchising people in prison or in some states, felons for their whole lives. That's something that's gotten attention recently on the presidential campaign trail. You can still share your thoughts over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up, more than 1 million species on the planet face extinction, according to a new report out this week from the United Nations. We'll talk to a Wisconsin-based biologist who's an expert on extinction. We'll talk about what it means for the planet to lose biodiversity and some of the potential solutions to try to turn things around. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.
From NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. A federal judge in Maryland says a Coast Guard officer accused of stockpiling weapons and drawing up a hit list should be released from detention while awaiting trial. NPR's Greg Myrie has this update.
U.S. Magistrate Judge Charles Day says he supports the pretrial release of Coast Guard Lieutenant Christopher Hassan. Conditions would include Hassan remaining in the house of his in-laws around the clock. However, prosecutors are appealing, and the 50-year-old Hassan remains jailed for now. He was arrested February 15th at Coast Guard headquarters in Washington and is charged with illegally possessing guns and drugs. Prosecutors say he also had a hit list of Democratic politicians and TV news anchors. But Hassan hasn't been charged with terrorism-related offenses, and Judge Day says that's why he supports pretrial release. The final decision is expected soon by a different federal judge. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
The FBI director says he has no evidence the agency illegally spied on the Trump campaign in 2016, something the president continues to assert. Speaking at a Senate committee hearing, FBI Director Chris Wray broke from what Attorney General William Barr told Congress last week. Barr said he believed the Trump campaign had been spied on during an investigation into potential collusion with Russia. Today, Senator Jeanine Shaheen asked Wray if he agrees with the Attorney General's allegation.
Do you have any evidence that any illegal surveillance into the campaigns or individuals associated with the campaigns by the FBI occurred?
I don't think I personally have any evidence of that sort.
Ray speaking with Senator Jeanine Shaheen. The FBI director told the Senate panel foreign interests, including Russia, are still working to disrupt U.S. elections, and some are more recognizable than others. This is NPR.
It's 4:32. This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Brady Carlson. Three Wisconsin residents died in Friday's explosion at a factory in Waukegan in northern Illinois. The Lake County, Illinois coroner identified two of the victims today who died in the blast at the AB Specialty Silicone. They are 57-year-old Jeff Cummings from Kenosha and 53-year-old Byron Bean of Brighton Township. Officials previously identified 29-year-old Alan Stevens of Salem, Wisconsin as a victim. Waukegan's Mayor Sam Cunningham says his community is there for those affected.
Myself, all the aldermen, and the entire city of Waukegan sending its condolences. We had a silent prayer last night at last night's council meeting, and we're continuing to not only pray with them, but we'll be here to assist with them as much as we can.
Cunningham said that as of midday Tuesday, there was still one worker unaccounted for. He said he heard from employees that facility managers worked to evacuate people before the blast took place. The cause of the explosion is still under investigation. A multi-year study of how frack sand mining and agriculture affect groundwater in Chippewa County has been released. Rich Kramer reports computer models show trout streams could be affected by increased water demand.
Researchers with the U.S. and state geological surveys partnered with Chippewa County and other stakeholders in 2012 2012 to study how mining and farm irrigation could affect groundwater. It found 70% of the region's water use went to agriculture, while 6% went to mines. Paul Juckum is with the USGS and says they saw the biggest potential impacts where streams initially form.
With the industrial sand minings, they tend to focus on the bluffs in that area, and that's where a lot of the headwater streams occur. So most of the effect is seen in terms of changes in base flow in those headwater streams.
Juckum says that's due to high-capacity wells and soil compaction at mine sites, which blocks rainwater from getting back into the aquifer. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The State Senate Elections Committee has voted unanimously to recommend confirmation of Megan Wolf as leader of the State Elections Commission more than a year after she started the job. Wolf has been serving in the position since March 2018 after the Republican majority Senate rejected confirmation of her predecessor, Mike Haas. Senate Republicans rejected Haas amid concerns about his role in an investigation into alleged campaign violations by then-Governor Scott Walker. No one spoke against Wolf's confirmation at today's hearing. You're listening to WPR News.
Support for WPR comes from UW-Madison. Every year, UW-Madison generates an economic impact of $15 billion for the state, supporting close to 200,000 jobs and sparking hundreds of startups. Impact.wisc.edu. Support also comes from the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra, with guests Mary McKenzie, soprano, and Timothy Jones, bass, performing a chamber symphony in 11 movements, May 10th at Capitol Theater, wcoconcerts.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show, the United States has an unusual real estate problem, too many big houses on the market. Kate Archer-Kent looks at the problem with a Wisconsin economist. That's tomorrow morning at 6:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, 1 million species of animals and plants face extinction, possibly within decades, according to a report announced yesterday by the United Nations. The report from more than 450 scientists across the globe finds that humans are largely to blame for the projected loss of biodiversity. The multinational assessment points to a number of human-related activities, things like plastic pollution and deforestation, as a contributing factor to the loss of life on the planet, and this can spell trouble for people and the planet as species go extinct. Stanley Temple is the Beers Bascom Professor Emeritus in Conservation for the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Senior Fellow at the Aldo Leopold Foundation. Stan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, can you talk about how they came up with this report and this number, a seven-digit number of possible species at risk of extinction?
Well, if you've been paying attention, this number really shouldn't come as a surprise. We've been tracking endangered species and the rate at which species have been going extinct for over 50 years now. So it's not that difficult to extrapolate the trends that we've seen over the last half century and project them forward. The other thing that has been done now is that the IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, has been steadily doing an assessment of the status of individual species. And they've done quite a few species now. They're up into the tens of thousands of species in the world that they have assessed, and they know what percentages of different taxonomic groups have become endangered. And they know how many total species there are in each of those taxonomic groups. So they're able to project forward and say, if the remaining species that we haven't assessed are endangered at the same rate as the ones we have, that's how they come up with this number of 1 million. But it shouldn't be a surprise. As I said, there have been lots of warnings that this was coming.
We'll spend a lot of time on causes here and possible solutions. But one point this report really highlighted, and they did in their release as well, is this isn't just a story about this being bad for nature and ecosystems. They say there's a human impact, an economic price tag, impact on our way of life. Can you talk about that part of the report?
Well, it's true. I mean, for a long time we've focused on individual endangered species, so, you know, we get excited about pandas and other charismatic species. But we're talking about biodiversity here. We're talking about the very thing that makes planet Earth unique, and that's that there are living things on this planet, and they are the best barometer of the health of the planet. And because we live on that planet, we should pay attention. Those species, the biodiversity of the planet, whether we're talking about genetic diversity or species diversity or ecosystem diversity, provides incredible, almost incalculable benefits to human beings. We think of it now often in terms of ecological services. These are things that nature does for us that, for reasons that are now becoming almost untenable, don't enter into our economic system. We don't account for all of the benefits that we get from biodiversity. It's like it's something that's sort of outside of the human society, and yet we depend on it. And everyone is aware of some of the most obvious, that we depend on pollinators to make our crops produce. We depend on living systems, ecosystems, to purify our water. We depend on coral reefs to provide nurseries for the fisheries of the seas. We depend on nature in so many ways that simply don't enter into our economy, that we've been blithely unaware, really, of how these systems have been deteriorating and how close many of them are to critical tipping points where they might collapse.
Talking to Stanley Temple from UW-Madison and the Aldo Leopold Foundation, looking at a new report from the United Nations showing a seven-digit number, over a million species around the world at risk of extinction. A lot of human causes behind that. Stan, let's get into those causes now. There are a lot of them listed here. What are some of the key ones, the fundamental ones that you're looking at?
The three big fundamental drivers, of course, all have to do with human activities. And we've known for a long time that the three big ones are the human population density on the planet. There are 7 billion of us on the planet, and as a result, we have a big ecological footprint. Add to that the fact that each of those individuals has a per capita consumption of the Earth's natural resources. And that consumption rate, the affluence, if you will, of the people living on the planet has been steadily increasing. So those people are demanding more and more of the planet. And finally, to get those resources that keep our current lifestyle going, we often use very damaging technologies. Obviously, the big one now is the burning of fossil fuels that provides us with the energy that fuels our society. Incredibly damaging to the environment, as we now know. So those are the three fundamental things. And obviously, that means that you can address the problem in one of three ways. You could address the problem by reducing the number of people on the planet. You could reduce the problem by reducing our affluence, by settling for lifestyles that are not so demanding of resources. And certainly we can turn away from damaging technologies and move toward technologies that satisfy our needs with less impact on the environment.
The report points toward one big manifestation of those causes that you just mentioned being habitat and loss of habitat, either completely or much smaller ranges for plants and animals that might have once been present on a much larger scale. Can you talk about the impact that has?
Well, that is certainly one of the big four consequences of the human footprint on the planet. We are taking up steadily more and more of the planet. Over 75% of the land area has been affected by people. Over a third of the land area has been devoted to agriculture and ranching. And when you look at freshwater systems, they are really strained. Large percentages of all the freshwater sources on the planet are under great, great stress. And those are not only the places that humans rely on for resources, those are the habitats for species. So as the habitat shrinks, the populations shrink, and eventually they get to a critically low size in which we categorize them as being endangered. We now know that many of the world's species are declining. And if we look at the ongoing rate of decline, it's clear that within the next few decades, many of these species are going to cross the threshold to becoming endangered. But that's just one of the problems. Habitat loss is obviously a big one, but there are other consequences of our human footprint. A second big issue has been the problem of overexploitation, that we're simply using the biological resources of the planet in an unsustainable way. The science is there to tell us how to live sustainably within our means and not damage these resources. But we haven't been doing that. So we've overexploited many species to depletion or even extinction. And these were species that were valuable to us. These were natural resources that sustained us, and yet we drove them to extinction. And as if that's not enough, we introduce invasive species. We bring species around the world and put them in places where they never belonged, and they cause havoc for the native biodiversity. And finally, the fourth is things that stress entire ecosystems, like pollution.
And the report points toward those different problems interacting with global warming, climate change. For example, I think one of the authors talked about, okay, if it was just global warming, well, maybe animals, plants could shift their habitat. They could move further north and have a similar environment. But with that habitat decline, the lower range, they don't have a place to move successfully.
Well, that's an increasing problem in some parts of the world where we expect that species under climate change conditions are going to have to move to new places. And although it's not a problem of habitat loss per se, it's often a problem of habitat fragmentation, that the remaining habitat, there may be collectively a large area, but if it's broken up into small pieces, often it's hard for plants and animals to move at the speed that they have to now, given the pace of climate change.
We're talking to Stanley Temple right now, Beers Bascom Professor Emeritus in Conservation at the UW-Madison and Senior Fellow at the Aldo Leopold Foundation. He's with us to talk about the latest UN report, which says humans have accelerated a mass extinction of species across the planet, over a million species at risk. Not only bad news for the species, for biodiversity, but for us, according to the report. We'll go to your calls now. Gary is with us in Boscobel. Gary, hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I've been on the front line of biological conservation and restoration for nearly 45 years in the field of prairie and savanna restoration here in Wisconsin, and formed an organization back in the 80s called the Prairie Enthusiasts, and we have about 1,500 to 1,700 members in the upper Midwest that are all working on trying to preserve the last bits and pieces of our tall grass prairie. And so we have this biological catastrophe happening right here in Grant County and Dane County and Joe Davies County in the upper Midwest. And to just tie together the importance of this biological diversity, all of the best farmland in the upper Midwest is growing on extinct tall grass prairies. And to save the bits and pieces of these ecological jewels is crucial, because they hold the blueprint in the species that can potentially rebuild these prairie soils in the future. But we're up against a terrible force here that seems to be insurmountable. We have literally very little information on how to manage and preserve these sites, how to protect the insect species there, how to protect the plants from changing seasons so their blooming dates are still in sync with the pollinators that depend on them.
Gary, I'm going to jump in and give Stanley Temple a chance to weigh in on that. Prairies here in Wisconsin, what do you make of what Gary had to say?
Well, prairies here in Wisconsin, of course, are a typical example of what's happened to many ecosystems, that they've not only shrunk in size, but they've become terribly fragmented. The problem is often that some of the most biologically diverse places on the planet, including our tall grass prairies of the Midwest, are the places that people most want to live and make a living, in this case through agriculture. So clearly, there's a couple of solutions that need to take place. First, we need to protect the remnants that are still left. But more than that, since these remnants exist in an agriculturally dominated landscape, we need to find ways to redo our approach to agriculture so that farms and ranches in the U.S. are more accommodating of biodiversity, and rather than being a serious problem, might actually be part of the solution. So dramatic changes in the way agriculture takes place is going to be part of the solution for ecosystems like tall grass prairies that are so valuable for their agricultural production.
Gary, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Connie in Portage. Connie, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am worried about everything and try to do my best by planting trees and doing as much as we can that way. But how can other people be concerned when our president doesn't believe in global warming?
Well, this is a real issue because all concerned citizens, of course, would like to do things themselves that would contribute to the solution. But that can only take us so far, given the magnitude of the problem that we're facing. Yes, every person on the planet needs to do their share. But more than that, we need the governments of the world, the politicians of the world, the policymakers to get together and put their collective energies into coming up with global solutions, because this is a global problem. And it certainly is alarming that a country like the United States, that has such a strong tradition of leadership in the conservation arena globally, has lagged behind, especially in recent decades. So it's far, far past the time when the problems that we're discussing can be ignored and minimized and not addressed. All the governments of the world need to get on board and do their share. And it can only be done at that high level.
Thanks for that call, Connie. We're talking to Stanley Temple from UW-Madison, looking at a UN report on biodiversity, finding over a million species around the planet at risk, mostly because of human activity. Stan, do you worry that people might go right to a point where the problem looks so overwhelming, biodiversity, global warming, all the things we've been talking about, that it's too late, there's skepticism, cynicism, and we just give up?
That is a problem with any of these big problems that humanity faces, including this one. But there certainly has been a groundswell of concern and support for doing the right thing. And I think that is encouraging. But if you are concerned, you need to do the right thing. You need to alter your personal choices, your lifestyle. But more than that, you need to put pressure on policymakers, politicians, to do the right thing collectively for our nation and for the population of the world.
Let's bring on another caller now. Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. I'm very concerned about this. And you talked about the prairies a little earlier and how we've lost those. We've also lost way too many wetlands, because the wetlands have such a biodiversity that has been created over billions of years and a very sensitive ecosystem. And when you talk, people talk about mitigating and restoring wetlands. I'm sorry, you can't mitigate, you can't restore what the earth has created over billions and billions of years, and we need to start saving our wetlands.
Cindy, thanks for the call. I've talked to one of your UW colleagues, I can't remember her name, Stan, who says a mitigated wetland or a new wetland does not equal a wetland that was already there and removed.
No, that's almost always the case with any attempt to recreate something that has been lost. And wetlands, of course, are extraordinarily important ecosystems. We often think of them as having hugely disproportionate ecosystem services in proportion to their area. So even though wetlands don't cover a large portion of the planet, they do a tremendous amount of service that benefits humanity. We obviously are experiencing floods at the very moment in the Midwest, and certainly the wetlands of the Midwest at one time helped prevent those types of floods. Wetlands filter water, and we know that water pollution, freshwater pollution, with chemical runoff from agricultural land, with siltation from runoff from agricultural land, from all the things that go into the waterways from our urban and suburban areas. Freshwater systems are in crisis, and wetlands are an important component of how those freshwater ecosystems work.
Thanks for that call, Cindy. In our last couple of minutes, Stan, can you talk about the solutions that the report offers that you think are the key starting points?
Well, addressing the immediate threats to biodiversity obviously should be a priority, and they to some extent are. So we have been very aggressively protecting some of the most sensitive natural areas in the world. So about 15% of the planet is already under some type of protection. Unfortunately, most of those places are deserts and mountains and the Arctic. They're not places that are rich in biodiversity. So we need to expand the protection of areas that are biodiverse. Invasive species should just simply not be a problem. We do, obviously, a great deal of due diligence keeping people out of our country. We need to keep species out of our countries as well. The other problem, overexploitation, is one that we should just get over this. We've long ago learned that we need to exploit resources sustainably, and there simply is no excuse today for overfishing, for example, and driving marine resources to depletion. And finally, the technologies that basically sustain our modern lifestyle need to shift. We need to move away from some of these technologies that are so damaging, like a carbon-based energy source for driving our society.
Do you see the political will there to do all those things?
Well, one can't be optimistic. And I've always said that as a conservationist, I'm hopeful. A hopeful person knows the odds are stacked and they're against them, but they're going to do their best anyway. An optimistic person knows the odds are in their favor, so they can kind of glide. But you can't be optimistic. We have to be hopeful, which means we're bucking the odds, but we have to do our best. And we know the way forward. It's no mystery what we need to do. The problem is basically having the will to get on with it and do the right thing for the planet.
Stan, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
You're welcome.
We've been talking to Stanley Temple, the Beers Bascom Professor Emeritus in Conservation at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's Senior Fellow at the Aldo Leopold Foundation. He joined us today to talk about the UN's latest report that paints a bleak, though he says unsurprising, picture of humanity's impact on the planet's biodiversity, a million-plus species at risk of extinction, and what steps could be taken to reverse that potential widespread extinction of the world's species.